Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is Friday, the Friday before Halloween. So fittingly enough, you know, it's true crime time, and I've got Jen with me. Jen, how are you?
Fantastic. How are you?
I'm doing well, and I think that I love the title that you came up for this, Murder in the Devil's Punch Bowl.
Yeah, and a little bit unconventional, but you know, the title's fitting.
It is, and it's fitting for Halloween. I think it's perfect. I've got a lot of thoughts about this case, and it's been spinning around in my head for a couple of days, so I'm excited to actually talk to you about it. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Jonathan Auger?
This guy was a 38-year-old canine sheriff's deputy with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, so, you know, kind of right there in your backyard. He worked SWAT, special operations. He'd even been in the Army Special Forces. And then one day, he disappeared.
He did. And this is where it gets interesting because he did SWAT. You know, and like you said, he was in special forces. I mean, this is a guy that could take care of himself, 38 years old. You know, he ran endurance races and things like that. So we're not talking about, you know, a police officer sitting around going to Winchell's every day.
Oh, no, this guy was like 6 feet tall, a buck 6'5", not someone that you want to tangled with. And if you did, then you would know, you know, you'd be in for a fight, basically.
You know, I mean, for sure. And, you know, he had done negotiators and standoffs. He'd done that. He'd served warrants. He conducted raids. I mean, this is somebody that, like you said, you're not going to get to him unless he's surprised. And he was set to run in a 100-mile endurance race. And it was something that I guess he had really, really looked forward to for a long time. He carried his race packet around with him. I mean, that's how much, you know, he wanted to do it. And, you know, it was it's a 20 plus hour trek, and it was through, you know, mountain terrain of Northern California. I mean, this guy was tough, and it was his dream to not only compete in it, but to finish it. And, you know, when you're doing these endurance races, you have to train every single day. This is, I mean, for long runs.
This is not absolutely. This is the physical and the mental. Both of those have to be there, and you get extreme bragging rights if you finish something like this.
Yeah. And I mean, one of the things that, you know, this is strange about me, but, you know, because I am not the most physically fit person in the entire world, I enjoy living vicariously through others. And one of the things that I enjoy watching are people who run these endurance races. And, you know, whatever kind of endurance race it is. And I like watching them train. And what I've discovered is that they spend a ton of time away from home, because on these kind of things, it's not like a marathon or a half marathon where you're just running a couple of miles a day and you're gone for 30 minutes. I mean, you're running almost a marathon just in your daily training runs. And you're having to do it, you know, in the mountains and everything like that, because you're trying to simulate, you know, an endurance run through the woods, essentially. And he liked to run in the Devil's Punch Bowl, which is in the Antelope Valley of the San Gabriel Mountain. So it's not that far away from LA. I mean, miles wise, it'll take you 18 hours to drive there, but it's only 60 miles away. And
this Devil's Punch Bowl, that's in the Angeles National Forest, right? Didn't that area just burn?
I mean, it's always on fire. And I guess that, you know, I mean, everything out there, it generally, you know, in LA, you know, we used to have that's kind of strange, and it's good to talk about it because it is that time. You know, fire season used to be in October, November. And, you know, for the longest time, you know, I have very few allergies, despite the fact that I, you know, used to get sick all the time, but I have very few allergies. But in October, November, with the winds coming in from the desert, I knew it was fire season and it was going to be hot, and I knew I was going to have some allergies. And generally the pattern in LA is that something will burn, take a year off because it has to grow again. And then the next year after that, then it'll burn. So, but this Devil's Punch Bowl, I mean, it's a massive area, but it was local to him. And, you know, it had desert terrain, steep canyons, And, you know, he had spent countless hours camping it and hiking it. He knew this backwards and forwards. And you would think that because it does burn, because it does clear, that somebody would stumble upon a skeleton, right, by now, unless he's not there. I mean, it's not a place that's not hiked. It's hiked all the time. It's a place that catches on fire. There's always firefighters out there. And, you know, they're trained to look for dead bodies, and they would, you know, see a skull or a human bone or something like that. You would think that you would see it. I mean, granted, it's been, what, 22 years?
It has, but if they stuffed him in somewhere like, you know, as we go on to talk about it, a canyon cavern or a hole or something like that, you know, people find skeletons all the time after areas burn. So now is as good a time as any to try to look for this guy, you know, if he's even there.
Yeah. And, you know, the Devil's Punch Bowl thing, I mean, it's a huge area, but there are hikes that you can do that are just a mile there. So, I mean, and that are super easy, but that's not what he was doing. And he left his home around noon, and it's June, so it was probably fairly hot that day. And he had the day off from work, so he could just take his time. And the area wasn't busy, but, you know, it's a national park, and there's people there who noticed that he parked his pickup truck. There was people there that noticed he, you know, put up the sun visor to block, you know, the sun from heating up the seats. You know, there was enough people there that they saw that he locked his doors, you know, and took off on foot wearing, you know, his backpack. And he actually ran into somebody that he knew.
Yeah, as a police officer, he went and spoke to different elementary and middle schools about what it's like to be an officer and things like that. And he happened to run into a school teacher that he had met previously, and she had her school class there at the Devil's Punch Bowl, and she was teaching him about nature. And she just happened to converse with him. And he said, hey, you know, I'm going to take a trek all the way up to the 9,400-foot summit of this Mount Baton Powell, and then I'll return by sunset. And she said he was in a really good mood.
Yeah. And if you think about it like this, I mean, this is noon. It is June. So sunset's probably, you know, 7:30, 8 o'clock. But, I mean, that still seems aggressive, you know, to run all the way to the top of the summit, come all the way back, and, you know, be there by sunset.
Yeah, just by that conversation alone, we question if he was being truthful with her.
It just seems really, really difficult, I mean, to do that. And, you know, there was a couple of park employees, and they kind of, you know, they monitored the area of the punch bowl, and they reported that they passed a man who fit OJ's description. And the man was jogging the path, which would seem right. I mean, he's not out there hiking. He's training for a run. So, of course, he's going to be jogging. And then there was, I guess about 6 o'clock, there was a third employee who monitored the visitor's parking area. And he says that he saw a man matching OJ's description and carrying a green backpack heading towards the parking lot. And just after he entered the parking lot, there was a single gunshot heard from the direction of the punch bowl, and visitors reported hearing the shot and looking up. That's the strangest eyewitness encounter.
Yeah, and this is the thing where we worry about if eyewitness accounts can even be credible, because seeing him at that time, if it was him, is exceptionally important to this case.
It is, and what I don't understand is, okay, so whoever this man is enters the parking lot. So, relative safety. It's 6 o'clock. It's 10 days before the longest day of the year. So, there's plenty of sunshine out. This is not, you know, somebody who's, you know, in the shadows of night or anything like that, where I can't really get a good look at him. And with the green backpack, it's 6 o'clock. And, you know, the gunshot was heard from the direction of the punch bowl. So, like, coming from the hiking area towards the parking lot? Or there was just a gunshot in the area of the punch bowl, right?
But to me, it sounds like just in the vicinity of the punch bowl. And you know how the canyons echoes off of them, so they couldn't really pinpoint, I don't think, unless they were up there, exactly where it came from.
No, that would be tough. But, I mean, there was enough people that they heard the shot, they looked up, again, so because this parking lot's not empty. This is not 6 p.m. in December. You know, this is 6 p.m. in June. And when he didn't get home by about 11 o'clock, his wife, Deborah, grew worried and reported him missing. And, you know, because it's a police officer, they didn't, you know, wait the 24 hours or anything like that. I mean, by the next day, 11:30 in the morning, you know, the Palmdale Sheriff's Office, I mean, they were launching this full-scale search and rescue mission. And Deborah claimed that it wasn't like him to take off without phoning her to tell her that he was running behind. He normally checked in with her.
He did, however.
And that's a big however you're about to say.
Yeah, because it was exposed that him and his wife were having marital problems at the time. So the list of what he would and would not share with her is exceptionally debatable. You know, he may not have told her what time he was coming back. He may not even have been coming back. That's the problem here.
That is a big problem here. And, you know, there was a fellow runner that he was having an affair with. And but we're 99.9% sure that it was just him out there and she was not there.
Maybe if you believe the mistress's story, her name is Davida. She said he told me he was going to go into the canyon. He was going to spend overnight at the punch bowl and he was going to meet a fellow deputy there. If he went on to meet a deputy up there and then only one of those men walked away, then, you know, there's a different set of problems because, you know, perhaps he was set up or whatnot. But as far as the wife knew, you know, Auger told her he was going to go up there alone. But, you know, the wife didn't even know at the time that he had a mistress. So, he, you know, like I said, the list of what he's telling her, we can't go by that.
Here's my thing about that. He knew the school teacher, right? He had just been in her class. And, you know, it seems that they had a, you know, a nice conversation. And she didn't mention anything about him saying that he was going to go take this scale, this mountain with anybody else.
Right. He never told her about meeting someone at the top or, you know, midway or anything like what Davida led people to believe. But, you know, the teacher was a stranger. Would he have divulged that type of information to her? I don't know.
No, not that part necessarily. But I mean, like I said, he carried the race pack. This guy was excited about this race. And one of the things that, you know, and we can talk about it later, but, you know, when you get into running these ultra marathons or these 100-mile things, they are extremely addictive. And, you know, people will race as many of them as they possibly can. They will participate in as many of them as they possibly can. Even if they can't finish, they're trying. And, you know, the theory that he may have disappeared, I'm just like, just check the you know, ultra marathoning, some new entrant who came in around 1998 that you had never seen their name before, and all of a sudden they started running. You know, it just...
Exactly. That's why when people enter witness protection, they tell them you have to give up absolutely everything that you ever knew because these people are going to be tracking your previous habits. You know, like you said, looking for you at the marathon races, knowing that you love running marathons, you know, looking for you to, I don't know, if you always go to Dragon Con, they're going to look for you at Dragon Con. They will look for you everywhere to hunt you down. So you have to give up everything. You're just a brand new person if you disappear.
Yeah. So, you know, and when the police got to, you know, the parking lot, I mean, his truck was exactly where he left it in the visitor's lot. You know, no one had entered it. Nobody had tampered with it. So then it goes back to that third eyewitness at 6 o'clock, you know, of him going back to the parking lot. You think to yourself, okay, it wasn't him. Because there were enough visitors, but it didn't seem like there was a ton of visitors in that parking lot. And I think that somebody would have noticed a guy in a green backpack going to a car that already had somebody in it, or that was somebody was standing there. You know,
exactly. You know how you were talking about you watched Border Patrol and they had the pink backpack thing or the pink suitcase. And they said,
yes,
there's no way that there could be someone that has an identical pink suitcase and then out rolled an identical pink suitcase.
Yes.
Okay, well, for instance, somebody probably came out that looked similar to Auger and he had on a green JanSport backpack. You know, it wasn't him. It was just someone else that looked similar to him and was sporting, you know, the same type of hiking gear. It
yeah.
happens. So
it
maybe Auger never left the canyon up there.
You know, to me, that kind of seems the more obvious because the visitors, you know, okay, we saw this guy, we saw, you know, we saw him leaving, we saw him putting up the sun visor, we saw this. You talked to the teacher. I mean, there was people who I have a tough time thinking that he came back, that was actually him, and that nobody in the parking lot saw him. It wasn't an empty parking lot, you know, but it wasn't full enough where, or crazy enough where, you know, a couple of people could have got together and met at a car, or had some kind of struggle, or he got in the car where somebody noticed.
True. I have a problem with one thing they found at the scene, though. They considered his car, or his truck rather, a crime scene. And after they opened it, there was something inside of it that makes me question if him or someone else came back to that truck. And it's the fact that he left his firearm on the console. No one would reasonably do that.
Yeah, you know, especially a police officer. You're not going to leave it out in plain sight like that. You know, and now he, you know, he had been special forces. He had trained in desert conditions. You know, I mean, the police weren't too concerned about his disappearance at first. It's June. It's not getting down to, you know, 10 degrees below zero, even at the top of this mountain or anything. You know, he could suffer for a while and be okay. And so I think, you know, they went into this, okay, we're going to find him. He's probably hurt or something like that, which is why he didn't come out. But they assumed that he was intelligent enough to survive while they looked for him. You know, that's that. I think that was the right assumption, you know, when you have a guy who's this well trained. And, you know, they operated that, you know, under this assumption that maybe he pulled a muscle or became injured, you know, and would slowly hobble down from the mountain. You know, it's.
Well, yeah, because it happens all the time. You know, the visitors, they'll start hiking, they'll bite off way more than they can chew. And before they know it, you know, they're losing stream midway. They'll sit down. And then it becomes dark, you know, and they have to deal with predators, and perhaps they don't have proper lighting and things like that. The search and rescue crews are used to looking for people like that. And, you know, if he did have a firearm on him, they assume he can take care of the predators and stuff. So while they're looking for him, you know, perhaps he's going to hobble out of the mountains at that point.
Yeah, you know, again, with my TV watching habits, there's this show about the New Hampshire, like, Fish and Wildlife Department or something. And they're always rescuing people off the mountains who did exactly what you said. They don't know what it's like exactly. So they go up there in just regular kind of clothes, and then it gets to be dark and they don't know how to get back down, and they're just stuck up there, and then they have to go rescue them. If that's the kind of thing, right, that, you know, they just kind of lose steam and they can't get back, or somebody's, you know, pulled a muscle or something, and so you have to go get rescued. This is not that situation, right? I mean, this
no,
guy,
unfortunately, I mean, they deploy everything. You know, with him being special forces, they bring in the Black Hawk helicopters. You know, his military friends are looking for him. They're deploying men to the tops of the mountains to look for him. He's not there. They have people on the ground looking for him, bloodhounds. There's no sign of this guy. And not only is there no sign of him, there's no sign of any clothing, his backpack, and there's no blood trail. So whatever the gunshot was about, you know, you think there would be a trail of blood. Nothing.
I wonder, you know, and this is again where we're going to have to go by what he had told the teacher. You know, I'm going up to this specific area, and I'm sure that there was one path up to that specific area. So, you know, I don't know how many
One, let's say, clear path to that area. Now, whether someone in special forces would take that path, or whether they would cut through brush and take a path that is more resistant. You know, he was training for this huge marathon. He didn't want to be challenged if he was looking for, you know, steep inclines and I don't know, like going through the brush and stuff, places that he shouldn't have been. And I question that when we go on to talk about some other stuff that he may have been into. You know, he could have ran into trouble if he was doing something like that.
For sure. Now, if he did that, my gut is that if he was really going to go up to the top, because he's jogging. This is not a hike. You know, he's jogging. And so you're going to want to stay on the most well-defined path possible. Because you don't, I mean, this race is in 2 weeks. You don't want to injure yourself, or anything like that. And, you know, that's the thing. 2 weeks later, this race went on without him, but people had hoped that he would surprise them by like popping up there and just kind of saying, oh, it was just a prank. But he didn't show up, obviously. And his wife knew he wasn't coming back, but where was he? What happened to him? you know, had someone followed him into the punch bowl and murdered him? Was that what the single gunshot was about? This is my problem with that single gunshot thing, is that he went in, you know, in the early, you know, noonish, and, you know, is somebody going to wait, you know, 6 hours for their chance? Maybe.
It all depends on if someone was waiting up there for him. If he was truly meeting someone, then yeah, they could have been lying in wait because he thinks he's going to meet a buddy and the guy is actually not a friend and he's waiting for the right opportunity to pop him. That's a theory, you know, that's something that could have went terribly wrong. If he was up there alone, you know, did he come across someone that he shouldn't have? You know, did he surprise someone by veering off course? That's another problem.
You know, the things about the veering off course, or did he fall from a canyon, you know, into a canyon or something like that. To me, there's no way that they wouldn't have found his body by now. There's just too many people in that forest and there's too many things always going on. They would have found, you know, the clothing or a bag. I mean, the dogs that they use for this kind of thing are really good at this. Did he take his own life? That's like so far down on my list. He did not take his own life.
Yeah, I don't consider that either. The dogs would have found something. You know, they would have hit on human decomposition, blood. There's nothing to go on here, which makes me think, is this guy even in a canyon?
Right. Did he fake his disappearance to start a new life? That is kind of, you know, where I have been on this. You know, it's kind of been where I've been leaning towards. I mean, there's some cons to that. He did not like his wife. So, okay. But apparently, you know, he had this huge bond with his daughter. And, you know, did he want to start a new life without her? Did he want to start a new life without this new girlfriend?
Well, that's the thing. Okay, so it's 1998 on that June day that he took off and was never seen again. The last thing that he said to his wife, who we know he's having problems with, is, have a nice life. Tell our daughter Chloe that I love her. To her, that sounded like he was checking out of the 12-year marriage. When she looks back on that now, she thinks it might be a man who was not just calling it quits on the marriage, but calling it quits on life. You know, was that some type of cryptic message that he was going to take his life?
Yeah, you know, here's where
it could have been like, hey, see ya, I'm going to start a new life.
Yeah, exactly. And here's the there was something that, okay. You know, this, I think his sister said that he had, you know, that he wanted to move to Alaska or something. He had fantasized about living there. You know, that he had plans to flee, that he was stashing money, obtaining a new identity, and that, you know, her brother was miserable living in the Antelope Valley, and he just wanted to move to the mountains. He wanted to be able to hike. He wanted to be able to fish. And at, I guess the last time she had was at a family wedding the month before he disappeared, and she said that he was ready to go, that he was checked out, that he was done. And also what he did was, at that same time, about a month before, there isn't, you know, 100% verbatim on this, but the wife in later interviews said that, you know, he had said that they should go their separate ways and that he had packed his running medals as well as his climbing and hiking memorabilia that had been on the walls of the spare room. He had returned a family heirloom bookshelf to his in-laws. He also gave a gold necklace of his father's to the girlfriend. So is that the end of a marriage, or is this, you know, I'm going to commit suicide? You know, it's just
usually when people start giving away a very private possessions like that, things that they love, like he loved his medals because he continued to do the marathons and he liked to collect them, for him to take those off the wall, give back the heirloom furniture, give away a necklace to his that his father gave him to the mistress. It's kind of reminiscent of Something to Remember Me By. So you look at somebody either checking out or walking away from their life.
And with him, like I said, I don't see him killing himself. I don't. And it could have been. So all of it makes sense to me. You know, he took the medals and stuff off the wall because he wanted those, maybe. And, if he was going to kill himself, he wouldn't have taken those down. I think he would have left them up. He could definitely give an heirloom back or something like that. But the thing is that if he killed himself, you know, it was going to his father-in-law. So, you know, his wife could have given it back to her dad. So that was kind of weird.
Maybe he was taking things out of the home that he didn't want her to end up with. Because if you die, you're still married. Doesn't matter if you're estranged. You know, possession's 9/10 of the law. She's still going to get it all. It's going to be up to her, probably, depending on what his will said. And I assume it's his wife that's going to mitigate who gets what. And maybe he didn't trust her. You know, hey, give my mistress a necklace. Would she?
Well, obviously not the mistress, the necklace. I mean, I get that part.
I mean, probably not. But the wife is operating off of a huge argument that they had while rolling down the interstate. You know, they were fighting in the car. He pulled out a gun. He put it to his head and he said, you know, what do you want me to do? Kill myself? And so she's replaying that over and over again, thinking, well, I mean, did he go and kill himself? But his buddy said, no, you know, don't think that the wife is so important that he would do something like that. Because at the end of the day, he loved the mistress. He was happier than ever. And the wife just was not a part of this at all. You know, she's exaggerating things or she's, you know, wanting to believe that she's important, which is, you know, kind of sad. But they're like, the guy wouldn't kill himself. OK, he's a survivalist.
The mistress thing, he might have said, look, I'm trading in, you know, one wife for this mistress who's also want to get married, and it's not going to change my situation. I'm still going to, you know, be living here, and I'm just going to be married to someone else. Yes, she's a runner, but, you know, if my goal is to go live in Alaska and things like that and be a loner, that doesn't really solve my problem. So here's a necklace, you know, thanks for everything. See you down the road, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah, and I buy into that story wholeheartedly because this guy was a loner. He loved to go off and fish alone, to be left alone. He only wanted to be around people when it was his idea, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, some people are like that, but it just, when you look at his character, everything points to a guy who is likely walking away. But
yeah,
on the morning, you know, he had a lot going on the morning that he disappeared. He's fighting with a wife. He called into his job. And he told his supervisor that he did not want to take the position of a firearms instructor, that he wanted to remain on the canine squad.
Because he liked that because he had his dog and, you know, the dog's part of the family. And also, you know, he was not big on socializing with the other police officers. He never went out with them, which, you know, there is a good deal of fraternization that goes on in a police department among officers. He would only hang out with, you know, his fellow runners, essentially. And that's, I think, just so he would have somebody to run with, not that he really wanted to hang out with them.
Well, I don't think he trusted anyone at the police department because every time he made a friend, he would find out there was something dirty about them. Because in 1998, unfortunately, there was a lot of police officers on the drug trafficking payroll, the drug manufacturing payroll. The Antelope Valley was full of people that were, you know, they would set up tents. They would basically be a meth production, you know, operation, and they would pay police officers to be lookouts for them, you know, let them know if there was going to be raids so that they could clean up their operation and move out ahead of the police coming in. And, you know, Ajay was the type of guy who was a hero. You know, he wanted to always be the good guy, and the other guys didn't think like that, so he distanced himself.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, he worked in special forces, so he would have made some enemies along that, you know, route. But I discount that it's somebody from his special forces past, because most of those would have been international kind of things. And I don't see somebody from his special forces past, you know, where he would have made a personal enough impression where they would come after him, you know, however many years he had been out in special forces. So I kind of put that one.
Yeah, they had forever to do that. You're right. I think it's more someone domestic.
Yeah. And now, as a police officer in Los Angeles, could have crossed paths with a lot of criminals that he had previously arrested, totally. And if someone followed him into the punch bowl, I mean, it's possible. I mean, I think that your average kind of criminal that, you know, he might have angered or something, are they going to come after him in the punch bowl? And
see,
are they going
to
be
seen? Who would have had the knowledge to know that he was going to run in the punch bowl that day?
Exactly.
They would need to have talked to either his wife or, say, perhaps one of the deputies that knew that he was going to be up there that afternoon.
And, you know, where he was going, you know, some average criminal that he arrested for carjacking or something like that, First of all, they're going to get him on the street or at his house. They're not going to go into the punch bowl. And no, second,
that's too much work.
are they? Yeah, exactly. And are they good enough where they're going to cover their tracks? Because there was no evidence to, you know, support that he was followed in at all.
Right. And even if they had went out to the desert and someone argued, oh, well, they swept their tracks. I mean, you still would have found some type of blood. The bloodhounds would have hit on something. Even if they were just walking in circles and couldn't find it, there would have been something.
Yeah. You know, and if he had fired, encountered a wild animal and shot it, you know, there would have been some kind of blood trail. There was no blood trail of him, like you said. There was just nothing there on this desert floor. Now, I will say this, that with special forces training, he probably learned how to, well, not even that. So special forces training, he probably learned how to evade things like, you know, tracker dogs and stuff. Plus, he had his own dog, this canine who, you know, I'm sure the lessons on, okay, this is what your canine can do and you can sniff and follow. So he knew what dogs could do and what they couldn't do.
Well, yeah, and the only thing is that with him being in special forces, you learn one thing. You need to move at night. You need to move during inclement weather. You need something to cover your tracks, you know, be it the rain or unless you're going to sweep up your own tracks as you go. You know, it didn't rain or anything like that. I feel like that he might have, planned that out just a little bit better because it was a dry day. But, yeah. I mean, he still could have disappeared.
Yeah. And, you know, and we don't know what was in the backpack. There could have been a different change of clothes that had been freshly washed or never worn by him. So then there wouldn't have been quite the scent.
Well, yeah, that, and also they always teach you to take off your backpack and bury it, you know, bury anything that you want to come back to later or bury anything that you don't want people to find. So not finding a backpack just means that people didn't dig.
Yeah. And so authorities got an anonymous tip from a woman who identified herself as an outlaw biker. And she heard that OJ had come across a drug manufacturing operation and he was going to be a hero and report what he saw and therefore was taken care of before being placed in a hole. Like you said, there was a lot of meth things. And, you know, I will say this, that National Forest in California, especially in Northern California more than Southern California, they have long been a hotbed of marijuana growing operations. And if you stumble across one of those, you may very well be killed.
Well, yeah, because they don't want to be exposed. And that goes back to me wondering, did he go off the path? Because these people that set up the drug operations, they're going to stay off a highly trafficked, you know, traffic path where they know hikers are known to go. But if he veered off and he went into the woods and he started poking around into places he probably shouldn't be, you know, did he come across one of these people and then they popped him?
Yeah, and I would say normally your average everyday hiker, even if they go off the path, then the meth people aren't going to be there. The meth people know that. They know where these hiking paths are. They're going to be so far off the hiking path that, you know, there's no chance of just your average everyday hiker running into their operation. And the other thing is that they usually have lookouts from the any kind of obvious means. You know, it could just be one lookout or something like that. But for the most obvious path in, and that person will usually try and warn off somebody and say, you need to get out of here or something like that. And, you know, is OJ the kind of guy who really cared about being a hero?
Yeah. His friends say, yeah, he was okay. a do-gooder. And the thing was, is that when you look at the Haggard court case, you had one of his fellow deputies who had worked on the force from 1998 all the way up until into the late 2000s. And then he ends up getting kicked off the force because he is prying too deeply into what's going on in the Antelope Valley. Auger knew about that at the time. You know, he probably would have been friends with this guy. So maybe not only did they get rid of Auger, they get rid of, you know, Hagger. And then, you know, the Hagger goes on to get terminated.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, cops were on the payroll, especially sheriffs, because this is, you know, an unincorporated area. So the sheriff's department ones are the ones that are on the payroll. And, you know, they could keep people away and, you know, they get a little cut of the profits, which is probably more than they made in salary. And, you know, I mean, the punch bowl, it's not some out of the way thing. I mean, it's got some fairly heavy foot traffic.
Oh, it does. You know? I mean, schools take their classrooms up there and they'll learn about nature and stuff like that. And you can go online and look at all the different stuff that they offer, all these different classes and just things for all ages. And you know, that was what's kind of sad about the thing burning down is there was a lot of really pretty stuff up there. Yes. But
now, let me ask you this. So he ran this almost not every day, but a lot of days, right? And ran this trail. Do you think that he maybe had noticed it before and it was doing something different this time? Do you think that, you know, he had a plan going in, he had seen it before, and this was the day he was going to do it? But I don't think so, because I think that he would have been smart enough to know if he was planning this in advance that he would have called in some kind of backup. So this
I'm stuck between this guy monitoring drug trafficking and being exceptionally nosy due to what was going on in his own department and the fact that some of his colleagues were getting the boot and that disturbed him, and then torn between him stepping out of his life because he told his sister, I'm done, that's it, I'm checking out. He tells the wife, I'm going up to the canyon for a day trip. He tells the mistress, it's going to be an overnight trip. You know, somebody that has that much going on, this is why people should never do this. If you're set up for an assassination, this is how they get away with it, because you're giving the hitman the perfect out because you have so much going on in your life and you've told so many lies that no one can figure it out. The water is so murky.
Would do you think that because his you know, this new love or whatever, that he would tell her the most true version of events?
No, I think he lied to absolutely everyone. I think it's just the perfect storm of lies.
You know, maybe
for him to
he tells
under.
Her, because he doesn't really care what he says to the wife, right? But the new mistress, you know, he has to say, I'm going to be gone overnight. So that way he doesn't have to, when he gets back home, he doesn't have to call her and talk to her. He gets an extra 12 hours or 15 hours or 24 hours where, you know, he doesn't have to make a phone call, where he can just, if he is disappearing, he's got that massive head start.
Yeah, it makes me wonder, though, why he told them where he was going to be at all. Why give them the real true location of where you're going to be jogging? Because monitors from the punch bowl did see him jogging up that path. You know, why not tell them you're going to go to a different national forest? And then that way, if something happens to you, you know, the trail really does run cold.
Yeah, and you know what? Here's the thing also, if he went out looking for the meth people, you know, he's jogging. You would think that he'd be, you know, more stealthy at some point. I feel as if he did stumble on meth people that day, that it would have been an accident that he discovered them. And maybe, like you said, because he went off the main trail and he went and did something that was, you know, unexpected. He went through the brush. Maybe he found some trail that he hadn't seen before. And he decided to give it, you know, a shot, and he went, and it was a trail used by the meth people. What I don't get is, so let's say he's out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, because it would have to be the middle of nowhere. I mean, you're cooking meth. It stinks, right? So you are out in the middle of nowhere. You come across the meth lab. They kill you. And how do they know which truck is his to go put the gun in?
I don't know. That's the thing. Did he leave a weapon out in full view like that? I mean, one of his fellow officers said, you just don't do that. You know, it's like fireworks. Someone could just see through your window, break in, steal your firearm, and then, you know, that's horrible. You don't know if it's going to be an adult stealing it, a kid stealing it. Imagine if teens got their hands on it. You know, it's just like the perfect storm of horrible things that could happen.
Yes.
But, I mean, there was another witness that came out, and while she's just really, really unsure about what she saw, she believes that she might have seen Auger arguing with two men on motorbikes. A lot of the people that operate in the Antelope Valley at that time that were cooking the meth, they would get in and out on their motorbikes. So I don't know. Did they say, go to your car and go put your gun up and come with us and take a talk? You know, I don't know, because that Hagger sheriff's deputy that he was friends with, you know, he went on to, of course, outlive Auger. But he did not survive staying at the department. He got terminated. This guy had arrested an informant, right? And the informant said, I know who's trafficking in the Antelope Valley, and I also know all the officers that are on the payroll of it. You know, I feel like if Auger had gotten to a list like that, You know, would he have started to hunt people down because he's special forces and he thinks that it's his job to do that? Because it said this guy gave 110% to the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department and that he would stop at nothing to make sure that he closed cases, you know, and did his best.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things is that, I mean, this was not just a couple of officers or whatever. I mean, this was a long legal case. I mean, just a ton of sheriff's deputies involved in the whole meth production and drug trafficking. And, you know, they would warn the drug manufacturers and traffickers of pending drug busts. They provide them with ample time to pack up their operations, bolt ahead. I mean, this was 35 police officers. This is not two or three. This is 35 officers were indicted for taking millions of dollars from drug dealers. 35 of them. And, you know, I mean, FBI surveillance captured a sergeant and two narcotics detectives accepting 30 grand from a drug dealer inside of his hotel. Another detective was arrested for hiding 150 grand of cash stolen by his colleague. You know, his former supervisor said that he assumed from the intelligence gathered that Ajay was murdered by a now, you know, retired sheriff's deputy.
Yeah, as they began to investigate, this one deputy's name just kept coming up over and over again. And then as they obtained the informant, he too gave that name. So they thought there was probably something to it.
But I just... I know what you're thinking.
Like, just how, right? But I mean, there has to be something to it because they gave the green light in 2004, you know, the LASD homicide detectives to investigate Ajay's case as to what happened to him. The detectives did a just fantastic job. They investigated. They came back with the same sheriff deputy's name. They said all intelligence points to this guy right here. Okay. So we've honed in on him. And then the captain at the time, he goes, no, stop. Stop investigating. I'm pulling all of you off the case. You know, I'm going to terminate you if you continue on. And then he just makes the digging cease. So what is that about?
Somebody who's still on the payroll, or maybe somebody who doesn't want somebody to look bad or to get back into it with, you know, because at that point, you know, a few years later, then the sheriff's department and all the officers, they're all out of this and people aren't talking about the meth thing. And maybe he doesn't want to bring it all up again.
Well, just, that sheriff that was named went on to have a stellar career and retire with honors. So,
you know, I just, how does, so I guess the sheriff, I just don't understand how it would happen because this is a guy who's about 2 weeks away from running a 100-mile endurance race. Okay. This is a guy that is flying, you know, up the side of that mountain, up that path. I mean, if you think about it, he was going to do the 100 miles in 20 hours. So 5 miles an hour on a path uphill. Okay. This sheriff's deputy, you know, is not going to be able to do that. He would have to know the exact path that Ajay was going to take. He would have to, you know, make sure that nobody saw him, that nobody was there at the exact time that Ajay passed by. Maybe there would be somebody else, you know, so he couldn't take the shot. You know, it's just, and then he'd have to make sure that he hit Ajay and brought him down and then, you know, hide the body, hide the backpack. It just so many ifs. So then, okay. So he waits for him in the parking lot because he knows what the guy's, you know, truck looks like. But like I said, it's not 10 o'clock at night. It's 6 o'clock. It's bright and sunny. There's people there.
Yeah, I feel like if there was just this bad confrontation, then people would have been more honed into it. You know, if you hear people arguing, you're going to try and look at them and, you know, figure out what the problem is. But maybe he never came down from the mountain. You know, maybe they stuffed him in one of those whatever they cook meth in, you know, whatever they have up there, a canister, whatever they're doing, you know, and then they transport it off through an ATV, or maybe they just carried his body, you know, off the back of a motorbike. Who knows? And I think that maybe the deputy probably got up there the same way. He didn't come in through the visitor side. He probably came in through the back and he, you know, motorbiked or ATV'd up there and was waiting on the guy. Why would he tell DeVita, you know, I'm going to meet this guy?
I know. I mean, I get that. I just... It would just take so much planning and precision, and I'm more likely to believe that he stumbled into a meth lab and they killed him and stuffed him into one of those barrels that would have, you know, the acid, which would, you know, basically disintegrate him. I mean, everybody's seen Breaking Bad in the bathtub. So
let me twist you and sit out. How about this? Okay, if he did walk away from life, perhaps the person that called in the tip that, hey, he's been dropped by the drug dealers. You know, don't look for him because they've done away with him. And then maybe he's out there living his life the whole time. Maybe that was one of his mistresses. You know, imagine she calls in the tip so that everybody looks the other way because this guy did say, I'm done. I'm checking out. I'm done. I'm finished with life.
Yeah, I mean.
And he was talking about moving to Alaska. It was his dream.
Yeah, and you know, and everybody says, oh, well, you know, he had this strong bond with his daughter. But like you said, I mean, it's not in question that he said, you know, tell Chloe that I love her, you know?
Yeah, and the thing is that, you know, if he was looking into all this and he was monitoring it, the DEA did come in behind him after he died or disappeared. They made 290 arrests. 35 of those were law enforcement officers, so they shut down major operations. And then on top of that, Hagar was awarded, the deputy that was terminated wrongfully, $4.5 million.
Yeah.
You know, for the wrongful termination. So did these guys all come out on top? You know, perhaps Auger bounced through the witness protection program. You know, he did his job, he was a good informant, and then he moved on.
You know, and what's also interesting is that, you know, Deborah had hired a private investigator to see if, you know, Auger was cheating on her. And the night he went missing, I guess she called the private investigator and, you know, maybe you can help find him, but that it was, I guess, it was going to be $500 to get started. So she said, no, you know, I don't have that kind of money. I have issues with this. Now, Vicky, the girlfriend, after Auger disappeared, she camped at the Devil's Punch Bowl and called out for him and, you know, waited for a reply and he never surfaced. And it's also interesting that even though they're having an affair, apparently the two had not had sex yet.
Yeah, he wanted her to submit to an HIV test before they consummated their relationship.
You know, to me, that's interesting, right? That's an interesting, you know, it's not that, you know, you don't have STD tests or whatever, and it is 1998. So, you know, but it seems to me that perhaps she had a past or whatever that he knew about that he wanted her to take this kind of test, right? That he suspected something was up. Plus, you know, she died in 2010. So she didn't live, you know, 12 years. And she said that, you know, that he never reached out to her.
Yeah, he never reached out. And then she goes on to die 12 years later. His canine dog died only weeks after he disappeared. And the dog was being boarded by Los Angeles County Sheriff's Office. They said the dog died from some type of artery problem. But the family, Auger's family, said that the dog died of broken heart syndrome. So, you know, did she die of broken heart syndrome too? Who knows?
I just, you know.
The thing is though, with him making her get an HIV test, he's a planner. Everything about this guy screams, I am a planner.
Yes.
That's what makes me think that he may have bounced, you know, that he had some type of clear cut plan as to how he was going to bail himself out of this horrible life that, you know, he no longer likes living.
So a week after he disappears, the supervisor finally opens up the pickup truck that they had preserved for evidence, and his badge and wallet were inside. Which to me, he's carrying a backpack. He could put the badge and wallet inside the backpack, you know, pretty easily. And I feel like, you know, especially if this is where, okay, he's not going to actually see the meth people that he's discovered before, because he'd have his badge with him. That's the way police officers are. And I find it hard to believe that, you know, if he's carrying a backpack, that he's not going to put his wallet in there. It'd be different if he was just out there in running shorts and a t-shirt, you know, but if he's got a backpack, I just feel like it would be in there.
Yeah. I mean, the only reason you wouldn't take your badge or any type of identification is if you could not stand the chance of it being on you if you were caught. You know, you couldn't be caught with something like that.
But if also, he was trying to go undercover and just, oh, I just stumbled on this meth lab. No, I'm not a police officer kind of thing.
I mean, yeah, what was he going to do? Hey, I'm one of you. I mean, hey, let me get in
there. This guy looked like a special forces. This guy just screamed cop when you looked at him. You know what I mean?
There was no hiding that. He looks like a Navy SEAL. If you saw him, the first thing you would think is not special forces, because most people, their minds don't go to that. They think, oh, he's built like a Navy SEAL. So he was definitely cop looking. I don't know, though. Like, taking that off, I mean, do we think that he came back to the truck, though, and then he put down the firearm, his badge, his wallet? You know, if you find a body with no ID, he was an officer. He knew how horrible that would be for them to sit there and guess, well, who is this? You know, whose backpack? Why would he not carry ID on him?
I think what you just said sums it up really well. He goes on his run. And his favorite place to run, right? His absolute favorite place to run. And comes back down, and maybe on the run, he just said, you know, now or never. Yeah, I want to run in that race 2 weeks from now, but it's now or never. And the run kind of gave him an alibi. Oh, he wouldn't miss that because, you know, that's something that he's been looking forward to. He talks to everybody about it. He keeps the race package with him. He talked to the teacher about it. But like you said, he's a planner, right? I've got to make this work exactly right. And so he comes back from his run at his favorite place, goes over to his truck, puts the badge and the wallet in the truck. Puts his gun in the truck. And remember, the thing about it being on full view on the center console of the truck, that story didn't come out until a few years later, right? So we're not sure, right? That was many years later that a deputy came forward to say that.
Yeah, because he felt bad. The police department put up a missing persons bulletin and also the posters in the national park, and they said, look for a guy, he's probably carrying a gun. And the deputy who saw the gun, the revolver sitting on his console, thought, what gun? He left it behind. But he stayed quiet about it. And the department just, you know, their thing was, well, he probably had another gun on him. But that deputy knew he probably didn't. I think he came back to the car. And this kind of like what seals the deal for me. Told everybody he's leaving his life. He puts everything that he's known for in the front seat of his car, full view. You know, wallet, badge, gun, walk away, I'm done. That's it.
Yes.
I'm done. Walking away from life. That identity is over. I'm now a new person.
And then that goes to that third witness at 6 o'clock who sees somebody with the green JanSport backpack going into the parking lot. And then, you know, they don't have anything else other than that, but that's him coming back, putting it in there. And then maybe meeting the outlaw biker, the woman who, you know, takes him on, whisks him on to his next life.
Yeah, because, I find it interesting, you know, that he could have possibly been outside speaking to someone on a motorbike, which could have served as his getaway out of the park. And then at the same time, you have the tip coming in from a female biker saying, oh, he's dead. You know, they dropped him up in the canyon because he came across a meth operation. Don't look for him anymore. Dead, dead, dead. But, you know, he's probably out there living his best life.
Yeah, and one of the things, you know, when the sister said, oh, that she thought he was putting away money, it totally could happen. And then she said, well, you know, he may have fired the gun into the air while at the punch bowl to leave, you know, an air of mystery. But I think they would have checked the gun, and so I'm not really sure about that one. You know, everybody had said the weekend before he disappeared, he did a 50-mile ultramarathon. And it was, you know, so that was his run, right? I'm not going to be able to do the 100-mile one in 2 weeks because of, you know, I'm just using that as alibi, but I got to run this 50-mile one.
And you know what struck me as odd? When you look at the story, the person, the park employee who's monitoring the parking lot says, I had just seen the guy that fit OJ's description with the green backpack. And then about that time, a shot rang out from the canyon. Do you think that is to get everyone to look that way? Feel like some type of divergence, like get everyone to look that way, and then he's going to go the other way? Because that woman, the employee never said where the guy went after that, because everyone was so busy looking towards the devil's punch bowl.
But it would have had to been somebody who, you know, okay, been out there, knew when to do it.
Yeah, you know? Maybe that deputy, whoever he was meeting, did, you know, they tell you not to tell any person when you're walking away from life. You can't tell anyone, but maybe he did. Maybe he said, I've had enough, you know. I don't know how close he was to this guy. You know, can you just do a shot, and then that way they can all look that way? I mean, I know it's far-fetched, but he's special forces. I don't know how deep this guy thinks.
Here's another thing. I mean, he'd always wanted to live in Alaska. And, you know, everybody in Alaska is there because they're running away from something, right? They want to be alone. If you want to be alone, Alaska is the place to go. He knew how to survive. You know, he could take care of himself. And it's entirely possible that he ended up there. You know, his last thing I saw about his wife from a few years ago was that she was homeless and living in a car. And then, you know, you and I just discovered that his daughter, Chloe, she died in March of this year at the age of 26. And judging by the fact that there's no obituary, and I saw something on a comment from LA Magazine, this article that was written 5 years ago, and it's a comment from this last March that said, you know, you never had a chance. So I'm guessing that it was something, you know, not like cancer.
Yeah, something unnatural. Yeah, that's really tragic. I assume that he had some type of life insurance through the Army and also through the police department, and they would have got that at some point when he would eventually was declared dead. His wife and I assume his daughter would have been the beneficiary.
And, you know, so and his daughter, Chloe, she died in Idaho. You know, it's a long way from Los Angeles. And last, you know, checked with the wife a few years ago, she was still in the Los Angeles area. So, you know, maybe he was up in Idaho at some point. You know, that's kind of like Alaska.
Interesting why she would be there.
It is. And she hadn't got married. She was still using her maiden name. So, you know, maybe at some point he said, don't tell your mom. But maybe you want to come up to Idaho. You know, it's a possibility.
Yeah.
Because Idaho and Montana, other places that you can go and, you know, be alone. What are your thoughts? What do you think? Do you think that it was, you know, with Darren Hager and he's, you know, when he gets the $4.5 million because he's terminated, you know, for looking too closely into this disappearance of OJ? I mean,
I know the police department thinks that he was likely murdered, but I think he walked away from his life. I think that he worked with the DEA as an informant and he turned a lot of these people in and then he bounced.
So, okay. So let me ask you that then. Do you think that he is witness protection or do you think that he just bounced?
I think that it was his intention to bounce and that witness protection is just a back end part of it. You know, they're like, okay, well, you know, since you want to walk away from life, it makes it easier on us because we can assist you with that. You know, he's turning on other police officers who were known to drop each other at the time in order to keep him from getting his head knocked off. They had to do something with him. So, you know, they kill him off, they end that identity, and they start a new one. And it's not that far-fetched when you look at how many different police officers were arrested, you know, like over 35 with 290 additional arrests of some really, really bad guys. I think he said, let's end it. And they said, yeah, let's end it.
And it was part of this. I mean, the DEA with this whole sheriff's thing, I mean, they arrested 300 people. And, you know, it was like 32 federal convictions for narcotic trafficking, manufacturing and things like that. So, I mean, this was just a massive, massive drug ring. And so.
And if you take down someone like that, you need to run. And he was the perfect candidate for witness protection. They like someone that's going to shut up. They like someone that's going to make sure they see the mission through. So could he completely abandon his life? Yes, because he was special forces and. When you tell him to do something, he's going to do it, and he's going to do it well.
Now, what are your thoughts? You think it's a witness protection so you think witness protection and not just straight bounce?
I think that the guy wanted to bounce, and he relayed that information to the DEA when he was working with them. You know, at that point in his life, 1998, June, he was no longer working for LASD. He was working for the DEA. He was like, forget them. They're all corrupt. And I'm going to work for you. And this is my plan. I'm going to turn over all these informants to you. I'm going to give you everything that you need because I've been jogging up there every single day. And while they think I'm just, you know, hiking and jogging, I'm taking pictures. I'm doing whatever. And then he bounces because he's like, I hate my life. I want to walk away. Can you help me do this? I'm like, well, yeah, because you're basically one of us. You're special forces. Of course, we'll help you with that. You know, he's a perfect person for witness protection. So I think he's off living his best life, and I really hope he is, you know, in the Alaskan wilderness somewhere.
Well, I mean, I hope he is too, but I wish he would tell this homicide detective Larry Brandenburg that he's okay, because this guy's been investigating the case for 20 years.
But you can't. That's the sad part. You have to leave all of those loose ends just hanging, because if you tell one person, you've told too many. They know bad guys too. Before you know it, they've slipped and told someone else, and then you have the people you're trying to escape hot back on your heels. You can't talk. You can't reach out to your mom. You can't.
I mean, this detective, he's still out there, you know, goes out to the punch bowl and things like that. And it just...
There's nothing worse than someone disappearing and you wondering what in the world happened to them. It'll eat you alive.
And just, yeah, you know, and... It's just, you know, and he's, you know, takes his dog up there and they still look for bodies. And, you know, it just, so I hope he's alive and living his best life. Because here's the thing. This Brandenburg guy has been looking for 20 years. And I just feel like even though, you know, if there was a dead body that he would have found it by now. I mean, it just, I don't know. I mean,
yeah,
obviously,
but you just can't fall for the bleeding heart, you know, just because someone's out there looking for you. Still, yeah. Just let me put this out there. They may not have the best intentions, okay? They might, but they might not. They might be working for the other people, and this happens all the time. And they just pretend they have a bleeding heart for you, and then the person accidentally reaches out, which is highly frowned upon. And next thing you know, they're dead. So guess what? That person was not on your side.
The one thing about Chloe again. So, as of, like I said, she just died this year, but I guess they had to wait, first of all, the wife had to wait 5 years to get the death certificate. And then only then could she get the contributions to his retirement account. I mean, 5 years is a long time. And she was pretty much out of money, the wife. I guess by 2013, her parents had both died, and she was just getting Social Security disability payments for OCD. It was about $1,000 a month or something, so that's why she was living in her car. And then Chloe, back then at least, had moved to Los Angeles to live with her boyfriend and his mother. So somehow, you know, in the intervening years, Chloe ended up in Idaho. You know, so it's just
kind
of...
Well, it's sad that basically her home base fell apart. She lost her father. Her mother became, it appears, unstable, you know, by no fault of her own. You know, perhaps she spun out of control after no one knew what happened to Alger. You know, that kind of stuff would tear a family apart. And then the girl didn't handle it very well. And, you know, Chloe might have just had a rough go of it.
So one last thing is that, so Deborah, at least as far as this last interview that she gave with LA Magazine back in 2015-ish, is that, you know, she thought that her husband still had committed suicide. But everybody's, okay, there's no evidence. I think the suicide is, I can't believe that for a second, so. And then she said that if he did leave, that Alaska was his destination, and that he had tried persuading her to move with him to an Alaskan town accessible only by airplane, and he'd sent away for real estate listings, but she wasn't interested.
Oh, well, you know, that's why he cut her out of his life.
Yeah.
He's like, I want to go. And she's like, I don't. And he's like, okay, well, I'm getting rid of you.
Exactly.
The thing with witness protection is that you don't normally get to go to the location that you told everyone that you were going to retire to. You know, if you advertised it heavily, they're unlikely to send you there. So that has me looking at Idaho again. You know, like,
yes,
what's up with Idaho?
Yeah. You know, you told everybody you want to go to Alaska, so we can't put you in Alaska, even though you could probably disappear there really easily. So we're going to put you to Idaho. And I don't know, but it just,
since everyone has such just conflicting theories, you know, the people that are dead set on him having committed suicide, the people that are dead set on this one deputy killing him. And then the people that swear, like the guys that know him from the army swear he has started a new life elsewhere, and they have information that, you know, leads them to believe that wholeheartedly. Three different theories, you know, that are, the people are that staunch in, makes me think that he's not dead.
Yeah, I don't think he's dead. I don't think he's dead at all. I could go with the witness protection thing, or I can go with the bounce, but he's alive somewhere.
Yeah, definitely. This was a guy that could get his hands on identities with or without the help of, you know, like federal officials.
Ooh, once again, a very interesting case that you found.
Quite the rabbit hole.
It is a rabbit hole. That's the thing. And it's just, it's one of those ones where I'm firmly convinced that he's not dead. The only way that you could convince me is he stumbled accidentally upon a meth lab. They shot him. They dumped him in a hydrochloric acid and that's it. That's the only way, that I think he's dead. I don't think that there was a deputy who was, you know, could set him up the way that it needed me. I don't see that. So, well, I hope that you, there's a little rumor, a little birdie told me that we might record a special episode tomorrow on Halloween.
Oh, I can neither confirm nor deny that. You just have to stay tuned. And while I'm at it, everyone, be sure to like this episode and share it, if you don't mind. Just share it with everyone. The more people that we get, the more content we can bring you, and it'll be amazing.
I agree 100%. So everybody have a great weekend. Have a happy Halloween. Stay safe.
Stay safe. Bye.
Bye.